In solid state circuitry, not so much. Although there are solid state devices that do operate on high voltages or high currents. And, but that, we'll save that for later. As far as voltages are concerned, you know, you just have to keep that in mind. And hopefully the voltages, I'm going to assume that the voltages are labeled on a schematic diagram, which will make it easier to try to figure out. All right, so, usually from a microphone, as I mentioned earlier, the audio from the cartridge goes into the radio and goes into a microphone amplifier stage. Sometimes they call it a preamp, or what have you. And one of the things I've also learned is what the tubes do. By the designation of the tube numbers, I can, you know, just from experience, I know what tube does what in most cases because I've seen it so many times. So, and that comes with experience. I'm not going to go into basic tube theory because that's another subject. But just the signal that goes into the tube and the signal that comes out of the tube. That's what we're going to concentrate on, not how the tube works right at this point. And again, I'm starting at the very first tube that the microphone element sees. So, again, I'm going to assume that you're going to use an oscilloscope because it's a lot easier. Although you could use a multimeter and you could see if there's any variations in the meter readings, which will tell you that something is changing somewhere. But with an oscilloscope, it's a lot, you can, you know, the oscilloscope is the eyes, which actually see what the circuit that it's looking at. And again, as Ed mentioned, you can get oscilloscopes really cheap, a couple of $100 or even less, and definitely worthwhile to have. Okay. This is WA2CDL, Andy's Corner. So, basically, a tube, and again, I'm not going to go into the theory of how it works, but I will say a tube has a number of elements, and just to mention that, and one of the elements is called a grid, one of the elements is called a plate, and one of the elements is called a filament. And that's just the basic tube. It's a three-element tube, but it's called a triode. Tri, meaning three. So they call it a triode, because it's got those three basic elements. It's got the grid, it's got the plate, it's got the filament. Triodes are normally used in microphone amplifiers because of their characteristics, the gate characteristics, and so on. Again, you have to know what element is what on the tube itself, so you know where to look. And if you have a schematic diagram which gives you voltages on each element of the tube, you'll be able to measure and see if those voltages meet spec. So. If you know where the signal comes into the tube, it always comes in on the grid. It's called the grid, which is a really, you know, just a fine mesh of wire inside the tube. It's called the grid. And then the plate is the collector of the signal, which then comes out of the tube and goes to the next stage or next location. So. And the filament obviously produces the electron current flow by the heating of the filament. So one of the first things you could do is to see if that tube is even lighting, if the filament is on. Sometimes, and I've seen this before, you look inside, you say, oh, it looks like this tube isn't lit. What would you do?
AT2, FFX.
Yes, KC2FFA. Hello. Go ahead.
Excellent, Andy. I'll make it your choice.
Pass it over to the next guy. I don't know his call or none, but that was excellent. Why don't you teach in a class somewhere, man? Teach somebody. Over to your buddy, and then I'll get the call signs correct. And we'll work from there. KC2FFF.
Okay, this is the Limark technical net, which meets on Sunday nights at 8 o'clock. So I'm giving a little talk about signal flow and what to check for and so on. And I didn't get the name. Just give me your name again.
Charlie. Sorry about that, Andy. I thought Dick used to run this, but I don't know. It's been a while since I listened, so. All right, back to you, Andy. KC2FFF.
Okay. Charlie, got you. Yeah, AC2GS Roy is running the net, and he's been running it for a while now and does a great job. So, very good. Thanks for coming in. All right, so, let me just recollect my thoughts where we left off.
KC2FFA, at the tubes, man. You were given a really, really good introduction to which wire, which does what, all this good stuff.
Yes, yes, yes. It's just, I understand, just the basic, basic tube function. All right. So again, as I mentioned, you know, if you have a schematic diagram which gives you the voltages, you can measure those voltages on the schematic. Again, if you could identify what the where the signal goes in, where the signal comes out, the grid where it goes in, and the plate where it comes out, if you know how to identify tubes, and you know which element is what, you can measure the voltages there and measure the signal with an oscilloscope to see if you have the signal there or if you don't. Okay, and of course I can get deeper in talking about the tube theory and what the waveform that you're going to see, you know, where it is and how it gets there and so on, but we're not going to go into that. We're just trying to figure out why we don't have any audio. So, the easiest thing for me is, I mentioned something before which I forgot, because my memory is so bad. I said before, maybe the tube is not lighting. Maybe the filament is out, which could happen. You could have a bad tube. Okay? One of the ways to see if the filament is lighting, let's say it is lighting, but you can't see it. Then you can touch the tube with your fingers and see if it's getting warm. Because some tubes get very, very hot. And I'm talking about very hot. And some tubes don't. So you could feel the temperature of the tube, the particular tube, and if it feels cold to the touch, like it's not lighting, that could be a clue. So that's one thing to do is use all your senses. You know, use your sense of smell, of course, sense of touch. Not sense of taste. You're not going to taste anything. Unless you want to lick a tube. But, you know, you can, you know, common sense will tell you. If something is working, you know, if you get some basic theory behind you, or something is not working. So let's say in this case, you don't see the filament because it's so dim, but you feel the tube and the tube feels warm. I would think there's a good bet that the filament is lit. Yeah, so some filaments in tubes, by the way, are kind of hidden deep inside where you really can't see it. And some are very bright and you can see them easily. So, you know, it depends on the tube construction. So it's just a little bit of information that I thought I would just mention that as far as the tube lighting. All right, so let's say it feels warm to the touch, and you're going to assume, okay, I filament is working, and now I'm going to look to see if I have a signal coming in and a signal going out. So I would take my multimeter, and I would place it on what's called the grid of the tube, which is the input of the tube. And two things. Number one, if I can measure a voltage there, which I normally should, whatever voltage it is, does it meet the same voltage that's labeled on the schematic diagram? Does it meet that spec? Of course, it could or it may not. Let's say it does, for argument's sake. Let's say you do have you measure the voltage and it looks like it's correct. You're seeing the right voltage. Okay. Now, I'm going to place my meter on the plate of the tube. And again, there's going to be high voltage on the plate. You got to be careful. Don't touch the lead with your hand, for sure. Because you'll have 200 volts, maybe even 300 volts on that lead. On the grid of the tube, no, you're not going to have a very high voltage there. But still, it's a good idea not to touch anything that you're going to be probing because of the voltages involved. Okay, so let's say, of course I'm just making all this up, let's say that according to the schematic diagram, you should have 185 volts. 185 volts on the plate of the tube. Again, if you could identify which the plate is, you'll know which. And I didn't mention this before. There are a certain number of pins on a tube, which plugs into a socket. And usually tubes are, and I should have mentioned this earlier, I didn't think of it. Miniature tubes are usually 9-pin or 7-pin. And those are on the miniature category. The older style tubes were known as octal tubes and had 8 pins, octal meaning 8. The miniature tubes in this particular radio that I bought had all miniature tubes, which was either a 9-pin or a 7-pin tube. That's a standard. And again, I didn't mention this because it just comes to mind now. The schematic diagram will normally give you the pin numbers of each pin on each tube, which will identify which tube, which pin is what element. So, and there's a certain sequence of starting from pin number one and working your way around to pin number seven or pin number nine. I always look from the bottom of the chassis, not the top of the tube socket, because it's just the opposite of what the pin numbers are usually labeled on a schematic, and that is looking underneath the radio and going in a clockwise direction. And there will be a space. There will be a wide space between the first pin and the last pin. That's how you identify which is the first pin number one, to the last pin, pin number seven or pin number nine. All right, W-8-2-CDO, this is Andy's Corner. So let's say, I'm going to backtrack again. You know, let's say the signal that you just measured was on pin number two, which is the input signal from your microphone. And you measure that voltage, and the voltage is correct. And you're talking to the microphone, and you do see it vary. So you're seeing a variation. Even on an oscilloscope, you'll see an audio waveform, or on a multimeter, you'll see on the DC scale, you will see a voltage change, or on an AC scale, on a multimeter, you'll see a change also because it is an AC signal. So you'll see it on both scales, looking at a pin of a tube. All right, not to confuse anybody by saying that. But let's move on, as we said, to the plate of the tube. Let's say the plate is pin number 5. So if we count the number of pins underneath the chassis, or if you, you could do it from the top of the chassis, but you just have to do it in the opposite direction. You got to go counterclockwise because you're looking from the top down rather than from the bottom up where the connections are made. So let's say it's pin number 5. You can count over 5 pins. And let's say it's 185 volts there, and you want to measure and see if you got 185 volts. Okay, so here you go measuring it. And guess what? You see 20 volts, or maybe 10 volts, or maybe nothing. That would raise a red flag right there. You would say, ah, I am missing something. Obviously, at that point, you probably are not going to see a signal from your microphone when you're talking to your mic. If you have a very low voltage. And now, you got to figure out why the voltage is low. And it could be for a number of reasons. Usually, or I should say in 99.99% of cases, the plate is connected to a network, which then connects it to the next stage. But also, the plate is connected to the power supply, which produces the voltage for that particular tube. Now, of course, I didn't go into power supplies at all, not yet, anyway. Because we're assuming the power supply is working only because the radio is turning on, it is receiving, and it is sending out a signal. So, with that in mind, I'm thinking, okay, the power supply must be good. Power supplies produce a number of different voltages for different stages. Even in your solid state, even in the latest technology radios, there are regulators all over the place. There are voltages for your microprocessor, there are voltages for your digital circuitry, they're all different. So, the power supply is basically, in my opinion, the heart of the radio. If you have a bad power supply or a voltage missing, then obviously the radio is not going to work. Okay, but in this case, I just assumed that the power supply is working only because the radio did turn on. I didn't see any smoke or flames. I didn't smell anything. But here we have a voltage situation where it's like from 185 down to 20 volts or so. So you're 185, like 165 down where you're supposed to be or so. As far as voltage is concerned, and obviously that's a problem. I once had this scenario where I saw something like this. So what I did was, I carefully looked with my eyes. I looked over the circuitry to see anything that looked burnt or black or something around that tube that would be obvious. And I did not see anything at all. Everything looked normal. On the plate of the tube, there's usually an element, and it's usually a resistor. It could be a transformer. Some device, some element, or component, I should say, not element, some component, which will allow the voltage to be on the plate, but will also transfer the signal to the next stage. And it's called a plate load element or a plate load component. And as I said, it could be a transformer, it could be a resistor. It's not a capacitor because DC will not go through a capacitor at all. If you put DC on a cap, you're not going to see DC on the opposite side of the cap because capacitors block DC voltages, and you need DC on the a DC voltage, a high voltage on the plate of the tube for the tube to work. capacitors in this nature are used for coupling the signal from one point to another. And there's a name for that. It's called a coupling capacitor. That's what they call it. A coupling cap or capacitor takes a signal from one location, couples it to the next location. So, it blocks DC voltage, but it lets the AC voltage go through the cap, the capacitor. And of course, from your basic theory of electronics, you know how a capacitor works, you know what it does, it has a certain reactant, and the capacitor is chosen, so it passes the signal that it's supposed to go through and blocks the DC voltage. So on one side of the capacitor, going to the plate of the tube, let's say pin 5, as I said earlier, I should measure a DC voltage there of 180-something volts. And as I said, it's only reading 20 volts. So something is loading down that 180 volts down to a 20-volt level. And that's, of course, that's not normal. So in this case, as I said, on the plate of the tube, there is a normally a resistor or a transformer, some component that gives a low resistance to DC and allows the DC to be on the plate of the tube. So I took my multimeter in this case, and this is something that I did, you know, a long time ago. I took my multimeter and I, again, measured the DC voltage on the plate. I see 20 volts. And then I went to the other side of the component that it's connected to. In this case, it was a resistor. In this case, it was a 47K resistor, 47,000 ohm resistor. Usually a resistor on a plate would be a pretty high value. You know, 47,000 ohms. It's not going to be like a 10 ohm resistor or 5 ohm. In most cases, of course, depending on the design of the circuitry, what it's used for. But in the typical audio amplifier stage, 47K, 56K, and so on, resistors are, you know, normal value ranges, approximately. Okay, so what I did was, I measured the voltage on the other side of the resistor that's connected to the power supply, according to the schematic, because again, I figured out, you know, where from the schematic and how it's connected. And guess what I saw? I saw about 190 volts on the other side of the resistor, the power supply side. But on the opposite side of the resistor, you know, the other side of it, I saw 20 volts. I said, okay, so there's a large voltage drop across that resistor. And of course, the question is what's causing it, and this is probably the reason why I don't have any audio. So what I did was, which was easy enough to do, I removed the tube from the socket. And that's the beauty of having tubes, because they plug into sockets. I pulled the tube out, thinking that maybe there's a problem in the tube that's causing this voltage to drop down. And to my surprise, I got to think back what I actually measured. Removing the tube, I saw, I'm going to make up a number because I don't remember exactly what it is. With the resistor open on one side, not connected to anything because the tube is pulled out, I'm seeing, you know, like maybe 30 volts or 40 volts or something like that. You know, some value that's much lower than what it's supposed to be. Now, mind you, the resistor is not connected to anything on one side. So I'm going from the power supply through resistor to nothing. No, not connected to anything. And I'm seeing a very low voltage. What does that tell me? It tells me that this resistor is dead. It's changed value. It can't be 47K. It must be a lot higher. Very high. Extremely high. And because there's no load on one side of the resistor, there's no why am I getting such a high voltage drop across the resistor that's not connected to anything? That resistor must be open. So, and this is a two case, by the way. So my next step, I turned off the radio, unplugged it from the line cord, and very important, I put my meter on the resistor end that's connected to the power supply, and I watched the power supply slowly discharge until it reached the level where it would be safe to touch. And that's important. When you're dealing with high voltages, you always have to make sure that your equipment, if you're going to touch anything or probe anything or measure something, that you want to check it for a bad component, turn the radio off and wait, or obviously you have to wait, but you got to, it's to be nice to put a meter across a component or even on the power supply itself if you know where to look, and watch that voltage bleed off to a very low value where it'd be safe. All right, so that's what I did in this case. The good news, we're almost there. I mean, I would think at this point that we more or less pinpointed the problem, like in the radio, of why we don't have any modulation, why we don't have any audio. So once the voltage bled down to a safe value, I then took my ohm meter, or I should say my multimeter, and I put it on the ohm scale. And on the ohm scale, it's, again, assuming that you know how to use an ohm meter, you know, on either a digital or analog meter, you know how to measure ohms, I measured the value of the resistor. And guess what I saw? The resistor was open. The meter just barely moved, even on the highest scale of resistance that I could read. So let's say I go to R times 100,000, or R times 10,000. You know, I'm just using that as an, I'm just saying those numbers because I know what the meters should, you know, my Simpson 260 gives scales that way, but, you know, set up that way. But my multimeter itself should measure the resistance in ohms, and I'm seeing a complete open. The reason why I'm measuring some 20 volts, which I saw originally, is because there is a little bit of leakage getting through that resistor because of the high voltage on one side. There is some conductivity through the resistor, but technically, it's not reading nowhere near the resistance it's supposed to read. It's much, much higher and showing me just about an open resistor. There's no resistance at all. It's open. So, with that in mind, I was able to replace the resistor with another one of the same value, 47K, which happens to be, I know the color code, again, because I've been doing this so long, 47 is yellow, violet, orange, and the 47,000 ohm resistor. I replaced it, and as soon as I replaced it, I spoke into the microphone, and guess what? I heard myself in the receiver, and I saw this particular radio also had a little modulation indicator, which I realized then was not even flashing. It gives you modulation peaks, so when you talk into the microphone, there's a little light that lights up, and now that light was lighting. It wasn't before. So my point is, with this little talk, I didn't have to go any further than that, than the first stage of the amplifier that the microphone sees. So, if I did have audio, going through that stage to the next stage, I would do the same thing with an oscilloscope. You measure the input of the tube, you measure the output, you see what you see over there at the output of the tube, either with an oscilloscope or a meter, keeping in mind the voltages, and then go to the next stage and the next stage and the next stage and so on until it goes to the, eventually it's going to meet a transformer of some type, and the transformer takes that modulation and matches it to the impedance of the final amplifier, which is then modulated by the audio. And that's what's known as amplitude modulation. You know, without getting into the design of that. But in this particular case, it was my first stage was bad. The first stage of audio amplification is where I lost the signal. And I had no audio. Okay, I think that was a pretty straightforward discussion on, you know, basic troubleshooting of an audio stage without getting into the RF or anything else. There's different classes of audio amplification, if you were not aware of that. Nowadays, the guys that are on 75 meters are running Class E, Class H, the pulse width modulation, and this is all AM. This is all amplitude modulation, but it's a different technique. And they're using solid state devices and so on, but, you know, the bottom line is it's still amplitude modulation. And it sounds really great. So there's been some really good designs that have come out over the years that takes the place of a modulation transformer. Because as far as modulation transformers, they can be big and heavy and bulky. And I'm talking about heavy. There are some transmitters which weigh a lot because of the transformers that are involved. And, of course, the power of the transmitter itself would determine the size of the transformer that's modulating. There is a rule of thumb. And again, it goes into the theory of if you have a plate modulated transmitter with, let's say, a DC input power. And remember I mentioned earlier efficiency, input, you know, output over input, and how an amplifier stage is designated as far as power output as opposed to power input. The rule of thumb is if you have, and just for information's sake, if you have a plate modulated transmitter that's got 100 watts of DC input power, in order to modulate 100%, which is basically the maximum that you want to get. You want to get 100% modulation. You don't want to over-modulate because then you're going to cause splatter, which is another theory in itself. But for the audio stage, and Ed probably knows this going way back, he's listening, your audio modulation power has to be at least half of your plate input power. That's 50%. So if you have 100 watts of DC input power going to your going to your final amplifier, your modulator has to be at least 50 watts of modulator power in order to modulate that 100 watt input power transmitter 100%. And there's a little bit of mathematics which I've done, not hard to do, but yeah, just have to know. It's in the amateur radio's handbook on how that's calculated. So you have to know that, you know, your modulator, this is a plate modulation. It's called high level modulation. Has to be that specification.
I'm here. Did you have a question?
No, I just figured you were listening to this whole thing.
Yes, and I'm enjoying it, actually.
All right, well, you've done this before, I'm sure. I mean, how many people use tubes in this day and age? Even though I do, you know, my 75 meter station is all tubes, which I like. I like tubes. Tubes have a certain fidelity, which if you're into audio, and you know these audio files that have expensive audio equipment, they love the sound of a good tube amplifier. As you know, because getting into the physics of it, solid state devices create noise, a different type of noise than what tubes. Tubes have a certain noise figure to them. Every device has a certain noise figure, which is a certain, which is a mathematical term. And as you know, of course, I'm not going to get into the discussion of the noise figure. Anything like that, but solid state devices, because of their design and how solid state devices work, do generate a certain kind of noise, which is different than a noise generated by a tube. Right, Ed? You know about that?
Yes, but I do have to say something. Are you ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
I agree with you 100%. But my comment is, if you look at this from a cold, rational engineering standpoint, these differences are of no consequence. There is no logical, clear reason been doing this. However, that leaves off the emotional aspect. It is a labor of love. It is literally a labor of love. The same way some guy will buy a 100-year-old car and restore it to pristine condition is why you, and to a lesser extent, I do this. We do this because we love it. And yes, there is an element of reliving our youth, but it's emotional. And any reason to try to give you a technical reason, I think, is just an excuse.
Yeah, I agree with that. WA2CBO. Yeah, there is a... like a love for radio. A love for old anchor radios, which people collect. And I get Electric Radio Magazine, Ed, and there's some really nice articles that have been written by many, many hams. Electric Radio started in 1989. I've been getting the issues every month since then. So I got a lot of issues. And they go into all sorts of stuff, including noise. You know, there was one guy that did evaluation of noise figure for tubes. Every tube has a noise figure to it, as you know, just like a solid-state device. So he was playing around with different tubes and making the comparisons of which one is the ones with the less noise figure. Especially a tube that's used as an RF amplifier in the front end of a receiver. I'm talking about the front end, receiving a signal. And, not to get into all discussion, but, all that stuff. So, anyway, yeah, I just brought that up, that there is a difference between solid state and tube as far as noise is concerned. And there's different types of noise also. Dick has spoken about that many times. So, so I just went over a basic troubleshooting point without actually showing on a YouTube video of where to look and what to do. But it gives just a basic idea of where to go, starting from the beginning and just working away until you see that, I lost something. And that implies to, receivers as well. You can lose a signal, or maybe a transmitter, your final amplifier, or, what have you. Or maybe a power supply. Maybe the radio just won't turn on. which is a case in the radio that I looked at. The radio had an issue and it just wouldn't turn on. And it was one of the newer radios. The thing is, I don't recommend anybody going into any of these new radios that are out on the market now because they're so complex. Besides, just to remove a part, you need special tools. You need good light, you need a good soldering iron, and it's expensive. Just the equipment just to get to remove the part is expensive in its own right.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
That's the first time I timed it out. WA2CDL, Andy's Corner here. Okay. So where was I? I forget so easily now at my age. You know, you get up there in age and you forget some basic stuff you just were talking about a second ago. All right, so we went over this. And as I said, you know, pertains to any kind of troubleshooting, but you got a basic idea. We can continue. We could talk about the rest of the modulation stage if you wanted to. We could talk about RF and how the RF is generated from a crystal and how it's amplified, how it's multiplied, and all that stuff. But again, I'm sticking with the basic. I'm talking about tubes because they're easy to see, easier to troubleshoot, rather than all this new solid-state stuff. You open up one of the newer radios, you look inside, and you see these microchips that's got 100-and-something pins on it that you can hardly see, and you just close up the radio and you say, forget it. Most companies in this day and age, you know, we live in a throwaway world. You know, look at your TVs that you guys can buy at a famous store somewhere. You pay $300 for one of these new, newfangled, is that the word? flat screen TVs that do so many different things. You know, they have what they call smart TVs. You can go on the internet with them. You try to troubleshoot one of those, it's impossible. I've actually fixed the power supply in one, but to get to it, to get it out, to remove it, you got to be very careful. If you break that display, whether it be an LCD display or what have you, you can't replace that. It's not worth fixing. We live in this throwaway world. So if you open up a radio and you see that there's a problem with it, I would think most, you send it back to the manufacturer. I don't think they would troubleshoot it down to a component. They would just probably replace the whole board. Pull the board out, put another one in, and that's it. It's quick, it's easy, and it saves time. And, to try to narrow it down to one little component with hundreds and thousands of components in a very small area, if you could do it, it's great. It takes a lot of skill and a lot of patience. I've done that because of my curiosity. I was able to do it.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
W2CDL. I'm listening to myself. So I'm gonna time it out. So I guess it's time I should lay back a little bit. So don't throw away your radios if something goes bad. depending on the problem. And if you have a tube radio, you could much more easily fix that, I'm sure, than what's out there now. All right. So with that, it's 10 to 10. A little bit earlier, but I think I just gave a pretty good explanation of where to start and where to wind up in this particular case. So we'll just continue next time. We'll see what else we can dig up to talk about. There's a lot of stuff, especially in this particular field. So we can talk about power supplies. You can talk about switching power supplies. You know, the list goes on and on. There's a lot of stuff. All right, 73, and thanks for having me on the corner again. Andy's corner. Roy, back to you. And Ed, thanks for your input also. AC2GS, WHCDL. Back to you, Roy. Hopefully you'll get into the repeater.
And to extend the question for Roy.
Okay, Wesley, you're recognized, but I just want to thank, hopefully everyone hears me, I want to thank Andy. That was another great episode of Andy's Corner, and I'm looking forward to next week's in addition. I'm a greedy guy. I just wanted to point out, because towards the very beginning of Andy's talk, he mentioned, and Dick used to mention it as well, that the output, the power output of a transmitter isn't inherently a 50-ohm match for the cable. There's an excellent article on the subject. If any of you people out there are members of the ARRL, you have access to not only QST but the other publications electronically. So you can go on a computer or an iPad and you can pull down this month's QEX, which has an interesting article with the title "Thoughts on Amplifier Output Impedance." The next line is a transmitter designed to drive a 50-ohm load at high efficiency does not necessarily have to output an impedance of 50 ohms. So if you're an ARRL member, it doesn't cost you anything. You just log on with your account and you can read the article. And it's rather fascinating, so please do. Anyway, thank you very much, Andy. I appreciate Andy's Corner a great deal and look forward to it. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, I have you, Wesley, down for a question or a topic. I just want to know if there's anyone else who has any other questions or topics tonight, because, you know, we still have a little time to fill. So please, if there's anyone else in addition to Wesley, give me your first name and your call sign. Okay. So, Wesley, what topic do you have for us today?
Yeah, I wonder if we have a time to go to how low can we go? Not long, but it's interesting, I believe.
Okay, we can discuss it. You can discuss it. The first article you sent me before the technical net, and I had a chance to read it. It was sort of fascinating. The guy basically took what he was using for a 180-meter antenna, and according to the article, he placed a loading coil that almost had a mile of wire in it, which is a hell of an inductor, in order to get it down to approximately 16 kilocycles, kilohertz, for very low frequency reception. The second article you sent me at the beginning of the technical net, so although I took a quick look at it, I really didn't have a chance to thoroughly read it. But if you want to discuss it, that's fine.
Yeah, it looks like I opened the worm can. It's like so many things come from it, and it's really, really interesting. So, yes, we have Paul Nicholson, and we have a W4DEX. Transmitted signals June 2nd and 3rd. That was in UK, and it was between UK and Virginia, United States. So we're talking about frequency of 9 kilohertz. Actually, the frequency was 8.971 kilohertz, and it was through Atlantic from North Carolina to UK. So it was kind of achievement. But interesting thing is that when we talk about the inverse square law, we have 150 microwatts effective radiated power. Let me wrap. So we're not even talking about milliwatts, we're talking about microwatts. Now, there is some different regulation for those kinds of licenses for ham radios in the United States. There is no license required. Below 9 kilohertz is not regulated. But even though the FCC license to transmit on 98.971s, he was asking if he needs any license for it. We're talking about something that is incredible that is taking place. And, of course, there was GPS lock carrier at 8.971 of kilohertz, and it was fully documented that this transmission took place. So the question would be how inverse square law works in this frequency. And to XGN, a quick question to you, Roy.
I don't think it works in any other different mode. It's a geometrical relationship. As long as your space is three-dimensional and you're emitting radiation, that radiation is going to dissipate as an inverse square. So I don't think it changes no matter what frequency that you use.
Well, I do have a problem with that, and let me go further. So we have 2200 meters band, we have a 630 meters band, and that's U.S. amateurs should register for those particular bands in United Telecoms Council in UK, but in here we don't. So we're talking about the frequencies of 150 kilohertz and 280 kilohertz. So as far as the U.S., the low frequency experimental radioactivity is usually very busy between 160 and 180 kilohertz region, and that is called 1750 meters. That is authorized by, under the Part 15 of FCC regulation. You don't need a license to operate in 1750 meters at all. For starters, you can run a 1 watt input, the transmitter final state, and the entire length of the transmission line of an antenna combined should not exceed 15 meters or approximately 50 feet, which is irony. But many people apply say, Tesla coil, and it works great for it. If you use 28-gauge wire, you have a humongous amount of wire in it, and the antenna is very short. So when we touch that subject of those frequencies, we should note that there are few hundred experimenters that occupy that mount in U.S., and several of them have set CW beacons at 170 meters, many of them between 180 and 190 kilohertz. So you have take a listen in if you have a receiver to tune to those regions. But the equipment is extremely inexpensive and could be done in a matter of minutes sometime. There are several HF and VHF transceivers that have general coverage receivers which tune down to 100 kHz and lower. And in one of the QST, there was the article showing how to build one and talking about sensitivity performance in 137 kilohertz. Now we're going down. How down we can go? So 9 kilohertz. There's a growing interest in amateur radio operation below 909 kilohertz, and this is a dreamer band because it doesn't need any license. So before 2010, there was few experimenters, and now it's getting really busy. Radiated power is low, antennas highly inefficient, and everything that was stacked against success. However, I remember and I recall the words of our great hero for 32 years, or even more, providing this net, who said, receivers are very forgiving. And if Dr. Roy could recall some of the quotes of our wonderful teacher, I would appreciate. Enjoy.
Well, there are thousands of hours of him archived on my KC2NJI's amateurradio.tv. But he was alluding to the fact that receivers are far more forgiving than transmitters. If you transmit an RF signal into a non-resonant antenna, you get reflections, and if your transmitter doesn't fold down the power, you get shorted out finals. Whereas a receiver is incredibly forgiving for a mismatch because it's capable of receiving a pittance of power. That, you know, as you mentioned, microvolts. You know, a low noise front end RF amplifier, and then IF stages and further amplification dramatically increase the signal. In the case of lower end frequencies, the background noise is problematic. So if you amplify it too much, you amplify the background noise. At higher frequencies, most of the noise is internal to the device, and that's why 2 meters and 70 centimeters often have a preamp circuit that people regularly use, because it will increase the external noise and signal and not the internal noise, and you'll get a better signal. So Dick regularly said that it's very forgiving. You could just take a random piece of wire and stick it out your window, and on a good day you could receive wonderful signals. Other days, not so wonderful.
And so we have the Dreamer band. It looks a little bit different from the perspective of Europe. In Europe, it covers 8.7 to 9.1 kilohertz. And there is a great interest in other parts of the world, including Alaska, mainland USA, Australia, and Japan. A number of stations have set up so-called grabbers receivers. I'm going to explain later what it is, but it's absolutely nothing there. It's just a regular amplifier for low frequency and a sound card, if you have one. But also, you can set a receiver connected to the internet so the transmitting stations and the other could be, so you can listen on your radio to the station, but you could listen to the same radio on the internet, and there's a program that is giving you the location of the signal, so you exactly know which frequency the signal is, and that's on the internet. At VLF, the receiving system can be very simple. So it is quite different from traditional HF radio because reception is at the near audio frequencies and the external noise limits reception, not a receiver noise figure. So there are two different factors. A suitable small antenna such as a voltage probe or just a loop is fed via the preamplifier, which is a high dynamic range, into the sound card of your PC. This is all they required for the detection of the signal, and the signal processing is done by PC. So we're talking that we had animal related telegraphy, which was CW, and we had to have a